With the coronavirus now officially a global pandemic, we have all become hygiene obsessed. So today on Embodied, we're going to press pause on our rolling news alerts and invite you to join us in a wide-ranging look at hygiene. From the individual habits that take place in the privacy of our showers to the institutional practices that shape our public health. Mike Dimple is with me to start this conversation. He's a lecturing fellow in Duke University's Thompson Writing Program and a graduate of UNC's Gilling School of Public Health. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And you can follow and join in on this conversation on social media. Tweet us with the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC or email us, sot@wunc.org, and we can put your questions to our guests today. So you've thought a lot about hygiene and how hygiene intersects with every aspect of our lives and intersects with institutional power. So I'm wondering what you think that the coronavirus has illuminated about the fragility of our public health system. What are you thinking right now?
Well, I think you said it. You know, the obvious thing is just how these systems are in such a fragile state. And I think it's also important to note that, you know, something like a, quote, public health system doesn't quite capture how we interact with institutions designed to maintain health or treat disease, right? In the U.S., private industries mediate access to healthcare, and those have been in a sort of set of intersecting crises for decades now. So the coronavirus pandemic is not really only a health crisis, it's a crisis that's revealing kind of fragility of underlying economic and social institutions. So I think it's important to kind of think about how we can think about like what that exposure means, not in terms of just disease risk, but like what those structures are doing, right? So, for example, the conversation right now about whether or not the vaccine can be affordable. What does that say about, you know, like what I would hope is a shared value for, you know, life itself? Certainly, we've had conversations about the economic value of human life at other moments in history, but they aren't really moments that we mark as highlighting the best of what it might mean to be human. And of course, like adding to the challenge is the fact that people who access what limited publicly available healthcare systems there are, maybe they use free services at a county health center or going to a public hospital that takes patients without insurance, or maybe they avoid health systems entirely. These are the people who are already likely to be most at risk for the economic fallout from the crisis and from disease exposure from the kind of work they might do.
Yeah, well, you heard the head of the WHO yesterday kind of talking about, you know, we have the health component of this, but we also need to think about the human rights component of these pandemics and how we treat the individuals who are at the intersection of everything that's happening. So we don't have a lot of time before we have to take a break, but I want you to kind of introduce us to this shift that we're going to talk a lot about over the course of the next hour and how we've thought about health over time. So we're kind of watching Purell, you know, flying off of the shelves, yet there's still a lot of bars of soap. So clearly our kind of what we emphasize when we talk about hygiene has changed a lot. Can you talk briefly about this shift in hygiene practices over time?
Well, I mean, what we can say, like, I think there's an important distinction that we can know about the difference maybe between cleanliness and hygiene. And I think the shorthand is that we can think about cleanliness as something that deals with like the very visible dirt or maybe like the actual smells of the human body, and that hygiene is something that tries to mediate exposure to microbial disease risk. And I think we do live in a time where these two have kind of merged in a world, you know, increasingly coated in a thin layer of hand sanitizer. And I think that these, again, track to major transformations in American society and, you know, modern society overall, and they bring us back to the 19th century and the introduction of piped water systems. We see the introduction of, you know, cleanliness commodities like soap and the privatization of, you know, what used to be, for example, public bathing practices. And we've gone from a culture that took a weekly bath to one that takes a daily shower, and a daily shower routine that, you know, has a different type of soap for every discernible body part. You know, I think that a key element here is the way that we understand the value of cleanliness as a social sort of set of practices, when in fact cleanliness and hygiene have always been deeply interconnected and really deeply interconnected to these larger structural systems that you know, inform how life operates. You know, it wasn't just that people were worried about disease in, you know, 1850 London or Paris or New York City. it was that working classes were dying from exposure to enteric disease. And
yeah, I'm going to pause you right there, Mike, so we have to take a quick break, but we will continue our conversation just ahead as we look more at hygiene and cleanliness, all of it on Unbodied today. Please stay with us. This is Embodied on the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We are talking today about hygiene. Given the growing anxiety around the coronavirus, it is a topic that is top of mind for many of us. Mike Dimple is still with me. He teaches writing at Duke University and has studied the labor that keeps domestic and institutional spaces clean, like housekeeping staff at a university. Also joining the conversation now is Elahe Izadi. She's a pop culture reporter for The Washington Post, and she's been tracking how social media and popular culture are responding to the coronavirus. Elahe, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And you can join our conversation on Twitter with the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. So you are someone that is tracking carefully, Elahe, how this conversation is happening in other spheres on popular culture and in social media. Tell me, what are the most interesting trends that you have seen recently?
Yeah, so especially online, so on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, where a lot of especially young people are, we're seeing folks sort of grapple with this pandemic and this sense of, okay, we're confronting something that feels so big and I don't know what to do with that threat and that feeling of anxiety, through making jokes about how it's affecting our everyday lives, with a lot of events being canceled, teleworking from home. There are a lot of hand-washing jokes. Like, I was interviewing a comedian, and he said he's never heard so many hand-washing jokes in his life. And actually, governments and other institutions around the world have used humor to put out PSAs about hand-washing. So there's, like, a lot of parody songs. There are memes about, these are the songs that you can sing while washing your hands to ensure that you wash them for 20 seconds or longer. So some of them have actually been educational. But yeah, a lot of the jokes, I think, have been about, you know, stocking up on toilet paper, sort of suiting up, but when you leave the house. And on television, we're seeing something a little bit different. I mean, we're seeing the coronavirus and the pandemic really affecting how television is even being made right now.
Yeah, well, I'm going to have us listen to a clip from The Late Show with Stephen Colbert last night. And a number of late night comedy hosts actually announced last night that they're going to be banning live audiences for a little while amid coronavirus concerns. So here's a clip of Stephen Colbert.
I don't know how you guys are feeling tonight, but I am staying positive. Not testing positive, just staying positive. Staying positive, I believe that the bottle of Purell is half full. Because somebody stole half my Purell, and I will find you.
Come on, Purell.
The coronavirus is still on everyone's minds, so don't forget to wash your minds. And I'll tell you all about the latest in tonight's edition of Going Viral.
Book your cruise now!
Now, over the weekend, the CDC posted some guidelines for people at risk of serious illness from the virus, including avoid crowds as much as possible. Okay. Okay.
You know, that is, you know, good advice, good advice.
Let's help everybody remember that. Chant it with me. Avoid crowds, avoid crowds, avoid crowds, avoid crowds. Excellent.
So that was a clip from Stephen Colbert's monologue last night on The Late Show, one of his last performances in front of a live audience for a while because of the coronavirus. And I'm speaking with Elahe Izadi, a pop culture reporter for The Washington Post, and Mike Dimple, a scholar at Duke University, is on the line as well. So, Mike, I'd love for you to weigh in here on this public anxiety around germs. I mean, you've said, you know, we like to think about hygiene as something very private, but it's really something that's at the intersection of our public and our private lives. So talk about what you think, what you make of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to even consider something like cleanliness or hygiene as ever really something personal, right? Like, why are we clean? Like, why do we take a shower in the morning? Think about, like, a day off you might have from work, right? What is, you're not going to, like, put your whole self together, perhaps just like pat around the house in your pajamas, but in a more serious way, right? Like, you know, our understanding of what hygiene practices are about has always been about some notion of our connection to a social fabric, right? To other people, to the fact that we live deeply interconnected lives. You know, so I think it's really interesting to see this sort of call about, you know, like avoiding social spaces with crowds of people and, you know, like all of these ways that we're trying to mediate exposure to disease at a time when we're, you know, we're really our most living our most kind of privatized possible culture, right? You know, like we actually don't have a lot of ways that we are interacting. This is not to say that it's not happening and we don't live intersecting lives, but like really the kind of way we are being taught to frame our approach to this is about like, what is my individual disease risk, right? Like what might I do to myself? Like, can I stock my own pantry? And those conversations, I think, are, again, ignoring who is most likely to be exposed to the disease on one hand and, you know, how we kind of organize the work of even being clean or hygienic in ways that are rely on a very invisible population of workers, housekeepers, janitors, nurses' aides, people who work in laundries at hospital systems, for example. These are people who are on the front lines of exposure here who are stuck between, you know, earning wages on the one hand and supporting their families. And it's sort of a missing element, I think, of how we're considering what's going on.
Well, it's interesting because last night we had Trump's public address and then we had this announcement that Tom Hanks says that he and his wife, Rita Wilson, have both tested positive for the virus. And kind of watching social media reaction to this, it's like a lot of people didn't realize it was real until Tom Hanks said that he tested positive. So let's listen to a clip from Tom Hanks' son, actually, Chet, talking about this news.
What's up, everyone? Yeah, it's true. My parents got coronavirus. Crazy. They're both down in Australia right now because my dad was shooting a movie down there. But I just got off the phone with them. They both are fine. They're not even that sick. They're not worried about it. They're not tripping, but they're going through the necessary health precautions, obviously. But I don't think it's anything to be too worried about. I appreciate everyone's concern and the well wishes, but I think it's all going to be all right.
So that's Chet Hanks talking about the news that his parents, Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson, have tested positive for the coronavirus. I'm talking with Elahe Izadi, a pop culture writer for The Washington Post, and Mike Demphal, a scholar at Duke University. So Elahe, talk about this. I mean, so we have these kind of, you know, these stories of nurses who are and you know, care workers who are on the front lines, and we're hearing those, but people really need a Tom Hanks to come out and say that he has coronavirus to take it seriously. What's going on there?
Yeah, and especially people in the United States, because in other countries, you've had some top officials who have not only been diagnosed and tested positive with corona, but in some countries, some have died. And so in the United States, obviously, Tom Hanks is a global star. But for him and his wife to say, we have this disease, yeah, or we have this virus, we've tested positive. Yeah, you know, I think it struck a chord for a lot of people, perhaps who weren't taking this seriously or didn't think or, you know, thought maybe the media was hyping it up. You know, there's a lot of conversation around what is that, how serious should we actually take it, especially when there's some mixed messaging coming from the federal government. But for him to come out and say that we have it, it raises an interesting point, though, which is in Australia, which is where they did the test. Testing is much easier to do and more widely available. They have not reported the same kind of shortages and issues with receiving testing as the United States is apparently facing right now. But also yesterday, an NBA player, too, and they suspended the season. So we're having some high profile people who are saying they've tested positive. It raises the question of who else actually has this but isn't able to receive a test, right? Who isn't able to even get to a healthcare provider to receive a test? If someone as rich and famous as Tom Hanks can get it, you know, anyone can get it is kind of the feeling about it.
Yeah. And I mean, there are all these kind of memes going around of, you know, how are you going to work from home? Like, how are you going to make sure you don't drive your dog crazy? And there's humor and there is, you know, stuff to make light of. But as you mentioned, Mike, I mean, there are people who are very much on the front lines of really making sure that these spaces stay clean. And I want to go a little bit more into that. And you've spent a lot of time kind of thinking about and researching people who are at the front lines of hygiene work. So tell us a bit about what you have learned about how their lives can be affected with things like this.
Well, you know, this I saw a little bit of a, you know, the Qantas, I don't know how to pronounce the Australian airline workers who were refusing to go on the airlines to clean the planes because of fear of exposure to the disease. And there was an airline executive who was quoted saying that he didn't have the authority to ensure their access to the proper safety equipment. And when it comes to the kind of the ways that we devalue sort of the basic work necessary to everyday life, you know, housekeeping is one of the most common. This question of being fairly treated at work in ways that don't put your body itself at risk through your working day has been going on since this work really became formally waged. In my own research, housekeepers have been asking for proper safety equipment since the 1930s. So it's a very old conversation about how people who do work that is, you know, structurally devalued because it's dirty, because it's done by, you know, gendered and racialized groups of people, have long been arguing for really the sort of basic consideration to not have their work also become a source of risk for them in ways that are already problematic when their wages are obviously extremely low, right? Their working conditions are already exceptionally sort of, you know, brutally organized in terms of their everyday work practices. You know, in the United States, 38% of nurses also have students and kids in school. A quarter of the population doesn't have access to paid family leave, right? These are questions of the intersection of kind of low-wage work like housekeeping and janitorial work and this kind of frontline service work and the broader conditions of our economy that mean these people are at exceptional risk.
Yeah. Elahe, there is also something to be learned about how different cultures and how different people of various socioeconomic statuses and various cultural groups define hygiene differently that can really come to the fore in moments like this. So what have you seen in terms of kind of popular culture offering us a glimpse into cultural differences around hygiene?
Yeah, you know, and social media especially is where we're seeing a lot of these conversations because it's a public space that anyone can kind of peer into, but it's almost like you're being invited into a beauty salon, you're being invited into a barbershop where smaller communities can kind of convene and share a shared and have their shared experience be present there, and we can all view in. So, for instance, I've seen a lot of things about different techniques of going to the bathroom instead of using toilet paper. A lot of the jokes around hoarding toilet paper people are joking from various backgrounds who use water instead of toilet paper. That, you know, we don't get why everyone's hoarding toilet paper, to wondering why people aren't washing their hands so thoroughly to begin with, to why don't people take their shoes off when they enter the house while we're talking about this. So, you know, these are some cultural things and people practice differently. You know, I'm of an Iranian background, and in Iran, people take off their shoes when they enter the house, and you kind of can't find toilet paper in a public restroom anyway. It's we have something called an uftab, and so I've seen a lot of memes about that, for instance. And, you know, we are kind of making light of something that is very serious, but humor can really provide this release valve for a sort of collective anxiety. And it is a tightrope to walk because when you are making jokes out of something that is very serious, you run the risk of making fun directly of people suffering and almost sort of congratulating yourself for not having to suffer in the same way. But if you do the joke right, if you do the meme right, it can resonate with folks and it can provide a release of anxiety and also a feeling that I'm seen and my experience is shared as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about various cultural practices because my dad is also from India and there's, you know, the cultural practice there around going to the bathroom is using water. You don't use toilet paper. You know, you wash yourself with your hands and with water, but then you're not supposed to use that same hand when you eat or when you, you know, go to the temple. So there's kind of these like embedded cultural practices around hygiene that may appear really odd to a Western audience, but have kind of developed over time to maintain a certain cultural notion of cleanliness. So I wonder, I mean, for you, Mike, when you look at Western ideas of cleanliness and hygiene as compared to other countries, do you think we ever get to a point where we take it too far? We have, you know, tried to remove too much bacteria. We're making our immune systems more compromised and our microbiomes less healthy because we're obsessed with, you know, ridding every possible germ.
Sure. Yeah, I know. I mean, I know this is a, you know, there's a, this notion of the hygiene hypothesis, which, you know, looks at just that question of, you know, like, why do we see people who have particular kinds of, you know, disease or allergy risk based on the health or exposure they have to the diverse microbiome as they're growing up. You know, like I grew up in a time when you could, for example, serve peanut butter on celery sticks at snack time. And obviously we no longer live in that sort of time, at least in the American context. And I think that, you know, we could equally see this not just in terms of the health of our microbiome, but in the sort of specific intensification we have around everyday practices, right? It's not that we take a weekly shower or a weekly bath. We take a daily shower, right? Like our practices have become micro-specific in terms of, I think, an idea that we are all sort of uniquely responsible for our own bodies when in reality we live in this, you know, sort of deeply interconnected society where all of those responsibilities are necessarily shared. And I think the current predicament with the coronavirus reveals, you know, how our lives are intersecting, and that our, you know, fragility is not so much squarely about individual health or individual cleanliness practices, but about the health and of our social life, right, of society itself. And we can see kind of how those are all intersecting in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, it also reveals how little some people do the day-to-day practices that many of us think as kind of standard public health. Like, apparently a lot of people didn't actually know how to wash their hands until recently, and because of all of the memes that we've seen. So, Elahe, I mean, what are some of the things that have struck you the most about things that have popped up in terms of, like, reteaching people certain behaviors?
Yeah, so like I mentioned before, there are governments around the world as well as comedians who have taken the notion of, okay, we don't know how to wash our hands, and turn it into sort of almost like performance art. There are a lot of memes around what songs to play or even have dances. I saw a video from a church where a gospel choir was singing how to wash your hands, and that you should wash your hands and then not touch your face and not touch other people. And so these are fun, but they also sort of do get lodged in our brains, right? About, you know, when we are out and about, maybe those are the things that we talk about with each other. But when we're in the bathroom and we go to wash our hands, then hopefully, you know, maybe one of these funny PSAs will take root. And on TikTok, which is a mobile platform that a lot of teens and middle schoolers use, and, you know, they develop these sort of videos, these sort of mashups and duets with other songs, I'm seeing a lot of almost absurdist veering on dark humor and sort of gallows humor around hygiene behavior, around washing your hands, around, you know, I've seen a joke about rolling up your hands in toilet paper so that you remember not to touch your face. You know, I've seen like people writing basically fan fiction, imagining different TV shows confronting the universe of a TV show, confronting coronavirus, like what would Seinfeld do? What would It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia do? So these are the sorts of jokes I'm seeing. Yeah, and a lot of things about quarantines as well, or social distancing, a lot of jokes about how, oh, this is the perfect time. Like, introverts have been preparing for this moment all their lives, that now all these events are getting canceled. Like, they're really enjoying themselves. So, yeah, these are the sorts of things I'm seeing pop up. And, you know, in some way, it is good, right? Like, especially if some of these jokes and videos and things that are going viral about washing your hands, if it's based in science and it's based on best practices, if it's based on what the CDC is recommending, that's much better than having a hoax go viral, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So. Okay, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but we will send guests to your Twitter and to information about both of you, which lives on our website, so you can learn more about their research and the sources that they recommend for getting your fact and your fiction and your funny all about the coronavirus. Mike Dimple, a lecturing fellow in Duke's Thompson Writing Program, and Elahe Azadi, a pop culture reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Where did you learn your personal hygiene practices? Was it from a quirky gym teacher, your dad, or your big sister? The people that teach us how to take care of our bodies as kids can influence how we do things decades down the line. There's also the more formal educational messages around hygiene, and those have certainly changed a lot throughout history. Just listen to this 1951 educational video, Soapy the Germ Fighter.
Wash, wash, wash. They just want me to be a sissy.
But then, one night, Billy had a dream. At least, I guess it was a dream.
I bet cowboys don't wash all the time.
But you're wrong, Billy. It's not sissy to be clean.
Okay, so there you go. A lot has changed since then. Joining me now to talk about education and hygiene are Kendra Madding Lampron and Skip Elsheimer. Kendra is a health teacher at Central Park School for Children in Durham and a graduate of UNC's Gillings School of Public Health. Kendra, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Skip Elsheimer is the founder of AV Geeks, one of the largest private collections of 16-millimeter educational films in the country. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Anita.
And you can join our conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. Okay, so let's start with the clip that we just heard. 1951, Soapy the Germ Fighter. So you've looked at all of these videos over time. So take us to that one and kind of what was going on in the conversation around hygiene at that point in time.
So the thing is that when the kid has the dream, Billy has the dream, it's a giant cake of soap that's dressed as a cowboy talking to him. And what's interesting about that is it's trying to convince boys specifically that it's okay to be clean by using what was a hero at that time, which were cowboys. And so the whole concept of like, well, I don't want to wash. It's sissy being washed. Girls are the clean ones. I don't care as much. It's like, no, here's why you can wash. The cowboys that you respect, look at how they're washing. And so it's trying to use that, the idea of a hero, to kind of convey the fact that you need to wash. And the film, as you watch it, talks about, well, there's these little tiny things called microbes, and they can cause sickness.
But there are so many kind of gender norms that are constantly reinforced in these videos. Let's listen to another one from 1956. This was a film called Keeping Neat and Clean.
Now, how about you, Mildred? Let's see what habits will help you keep neat and clean. You need a weekly shampoo, too, of course. Girls have to wash their hair in the afternoon or evening, so there's time to put it up. Don't go to bed with wet hair. Putting up your hair is something you have to learn, and everyone does it differently. It depends on how you wear it. You may still need to get help from your mother on this. This is a good time to trim your fingernails. Make a habit of doing it the day you wash your hair. Boys like to use fingernail clippers, but girls can shape them better with an emery board. Before you put on your dress, it's a good idea to brush your hair. Be sure you've washed your brush. Don't put a dirty brush on clean hair. Brush and brush and brush at least 100 strokes.
Okay, that was a clip from Keeping Neat and Clean, a 1956 educational video. I'm talking with Skip Elsheimer, founder of AV Geeks, which archives this kind of educational footage. And Kendra Madding Lampron is with me also. She teaches health at Central Park School for Children. So, Kendra, tell me about what is going on in classrooms today. I'm guessing we're far from the 100 strokes at this point.
Yeah, I definitely don't teach that. And I don't go over a ton of hygiene at the middle school level. That's more of an elementary school standard. We talk about some sexual hygiene, menstrual hygiene, but we're not talking about hand washing as much. Now, this week, we're talking a lot about hand washing and how to do that best during the time of coronavirus. But before now, I really haven't touched much on hand washing at the middle school level.
But talk about gender and how it plays out in how you teach about hygiene. Because I remember when I was, I guess, in elementary and then in middle school, we were still separated, girls and boys. Mm-hmm. So at this stage, I mean, how do you handle gender differences in middle school for people who maybe don't identify with one particular gender? And is it still the kind of thing where you're educating separately?
No. So it's best practice to not separate anymore. So we're not doing that. I keep them all in one classroom, both because we have those kids who are gender nonconforming and we don't want to make them uncomfortable choosing a classroom to go to. And also because we're really trying to emphasize that 90%, if not more, of what we're going through is the same. So I have them do these card sorts where they sort what's happening to males during puberty, what's happening to females, and what's happening to both. And they end up seeing that the both category is huge and these individual differences are very small. So we're mostly going through the same things. And that really kind of destigmatizes what the other gender is going through.
Because in so much of these videos, you can kind of see that they're trying to, I mean, yes, they're trying to teach them basic behaviors, but they're also trying to reinforce particular cultural norms and narratives. So, Skip, what kind of stands out to you about the kinds of narratives that are really being reinforced in these films?
Well, so they're doing status quo, what was happening at the time. And they come off as kind of corny and stale, but they were very progressive at the time. Hmm. I mean, the whole idea that you have a film that teaches you how to wash your hands is... and how to keep clean. Like, why would a school care about whether a kid is going to be clean or not? So you think about that. And it's because of the stigma that is associated because of some public health concerns. But it's really they're trying to pick up the slack that a parent maybe hasn't fulfilled.
So how do you differentiate for you, Kendra, the difference between kind of something that is contributing toward public health and something that is really just a kind of a social norm that doesn't really have any scientific backing?
Well, we talk a lot about social norms and, you know, what social norms are so that we can distinguish between what those two things are. But, you know, when we talk about STIs when it comes to public health and how to best not spread STIs. So, we actually talk about that distinguishment in class.
And are you able to help distinguish kind of the, you know, I think about kind of learning about menstruation and these conversations around puberty, and there's a lot of language socially around things that are clean and unclean when it comes to, you know, blood and getting your period for the first time. How do you avoid kind of reinforcing particular social norms around some of these aspects of puberty that have been loaded with that kind of language over time?
Well, I think starting young, so we start talking about puberty and menstrual hygiene in fourth grade, kind of before some of those things are ingrained in kids. And I think because we never separate by gender, boys end up feeling really comfortable asking questions about menstrual hygiene in class. And I show how to use a tampon, and I show how to use a menstrual cup, and I show how to use pads, and I bring them in, and I let them hold them and feel them, both sexes, so that both sexes and genders understand what they are. And I think that's a huge part of the destigmatization. We write these school health grants every year in sixth grade. And we actually had a group of boys and girls write a grant for a free tampon and pad machine to put in the girls' bathroom. So
that's pretty
awesome.
I think
that kind of helps to start at that younger age talking about it.
But you're not the only one giving them information. So these kids are obviously also on TikTok and on Twitter and on Instagram. Do you hear conversations that emerge from those spaces come up in your conversations around health?
Absolutely. So every year there's the new iteration of the question that I don't know exactly where it's coming from, and it's kind of weird. This year I was pretty thrown off the first time I was asked, do girls really eat their tampons?
Eat their tampons.
Eat their tampons. And it kept coming up. So I ended up looking it up and realizing that this young woman had made a TikTok video saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe boys don't know that girls eat their tampons to get their blood back. And then it just went viral and all of these young women were posting about, oh my gosh, boys, they're so silly. They don't know that we get the blood back in this way. So I was getting a lot of questions about that and, you know, had to let everyone know that that was indeed not hygienic to eat tampons, and that that was kind of just playing on the fact that maybe boys don't know enough about menstrual hygiene and about girls and their bodies. So
that
was an interesting one.
Yeah, because you also see, I mean, with the coronavirus, there's kind of an attempt to push back against misinformation
yes.
spreading online. And there was this really interesting kind of lineup of various governmental PSAs and ways that, you know, governments are trying to push back and shape the narrative. So I want to listen to one of those now and have Skip, maybe you respond to what you're hearing in this. So here's an example from Singapore that illustrates kind of how message delivery has changed over time and what they're trying to do with relation to corona.
Busy at work?
Nah, just my group chats. Sending me the latest news about the virus outbreak.
Hey, make sure you're not listening to those rumors. Okay, get your updates from the proper channel, like the Ministry of Health website.
Yeah, I know. I'm so stressed.
We'll be fine, as long as we support and take care of each other.
And wash our hands frequently with soap and water.
And not touch our face.
Every time someone tells me not to touch my face, I feel like touching my face.
We need to stay calm and use our common sense. Not shun others or make them feel unwelcome.
So that was a public service announcement out of Singapore about how to handle the spread of the coronavirus. And I'm talking with Skip Elsheimer, founder of AV Geeks, and Kendra Madding-Lampron, who teaches health at Central Park School for Children in Durham. So, Skip, what do you hear in that in terms of how the government is framing this message, and how does it compare to what you've seen over history?
Well, so, yes, I mean, you want a clear message to be sent from someone who is knowledgeable and to try to dispel all the rumors, and rumors will always be there. They've been there since the beginning of history. So the other part of this is, how do you get a message that's going to stick? And so I think there's a lot of PSAs out there that now have singing related to it. The person in the previous segment was talking about that. Like, there's all these novel ways to get that word out. And that's why Soapy the Germ Fighter exists, is like, how do we get boys interested in cleaning themselves? Like, we'll come up with this novel idea of this giant cake of soap talking to him that's dressed as a cowboy. And, you know, how do we get those messages out in a way that they'll stick? Like, is it a song that's really catchy? Something, you know, something like that.
Kendra, what's going on in the classroom right now? I mean, how are you trying to get these messages to stick?
I've definitely we're doing our sexual health unit right now, but I kind of shifted a hard shift away from it to talk about coronavirus with them a little bit. And we're mostly just kind of trying to quell anxiety. A lot of kids are feeling really anxious about it because of social media and the news and maybe some things they're hearing from their parents. So we're mostly just trying to answer their questions, quell those anxieties, and make kids feel more comfortable, but also know that it's really important right now to wash hands and not touch face and keep that social distance as much as possible.
What are some of the most surprising questions you've gotten about Corona so far?
A lot of them are taking some of those myths and misconceptions and running with them. I've been asked a ton of questions about how it started and whether it started in a lab and whether certain types of people eat certain types of food and that's how these things start. So they're really interested in how it got here and who's getting it.
Skip, what's the role of these educational videos in kind of reifying stereotypes around where certain practices come from? Because, yeah, we've seen that with Corona, that at the beginning there was a lot of, you know, misinformation about the kinds of people that could get it and could not get it. Do you see these videos trying to curb that narrative, or do they end up kind of adding to
They're stigma? Trying to do it. It's almost always a personal appeal to there are germs out there. They don't say where they come from. They're just germs out there. This is how you protect yourself on a personal level. Because at the time, you know, they oftentimes didn't know where different germs come from in the 50s and the 30s, the 40s. And so it's all about, like, you and your local community and you as your person and how you keep yourself clean and safe.
And how about kind of practices in the name of cleanliness that don't actually serve us, like douching, for example? I know that comes up a lot in your sexual health conversations with kids.
Yeah, it does sometimes. We talk about douching as a not good way to help with sexually transmitted infections, and in fact, a way that could make them worse. So that's really the only time that douching comes up. It actually comes up less than I think it used to, which is maybe because of good messaging.
Are there any narratives around things like that that you see in any of these videos, like trying to kind of combat existing stereotypes about things that we think help us with cleanliness or hygiene?
Well, so to kind of jump on to what she's saying about the STIs, I have a lot of venereal disease films as well, and they address a lot of the misnomers about doorknobs and toilet seats and, you know, how do you get it? And so there's a lot of discounting of that. And also the fact that people were getting treated with things that were not cures at all. They weren't getting treated with antibiotics. They were getting treated by things that they bought on a street corner.
How about the people that help keep our spaces clean? Like we've talked about in earlier parts of this conversation, you know, housekeepers and cleaning staff within our schools, within our buildings. do have conversations about that with kids in terms of kind of how to respect the people that are keeping our spaces clean and how to think about hygiene kind of on the institutional level?
Yes. I mean, I feel like I'm constantly telling middle schoolers to keep certain areas clean. And I feel lucky in that I'm at a pretty small school where we know our custodial staff and the kids know the custodial staff. So you can even just point to and say, you know, hey, you know, this custodian isn't going to be very happy about cleaning that mess up. And they know who that person is. And so they feel a little more like they want to help them out by keeping the space cleaner.
Are there any videos that illuminate the identities of those hygiene workers and anything that you've seen?
Well, so I have a lot of different films that cover lots of different. And so I do have ones made for sanitation workers and for people that are cleaning up in specifically hospitals and about how you kind of limit your exposure to microbes that could cause you damage or you could accidentally spread it to other parts of the hospital. So, yes, there's many out there.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but what are you all each kind of thinking about the most right now in terms of your own personal hygiene as this corona spread continues?
Well, luckily, I'm in a year-round school, and we're about to go on spring break, so that's kind of going to contain it, and I can quarantine on spring break without having to miss any school or work.
How about you, Skip?
Thankfully, I work with a bunch of films, and so, you know, I'm kind of, like, hidden away, but, you know, I'm washing my hands a lot more. I'm thinking back to, it's so many times that the films I have come back as being important, and so this is one of those times.
All right, well, we'll put links to some of those films on our website so you all can see them and see how our narratives around hygiene have changed over time. I've been speaking with Skip Elsheimer, the founder of AV Geeks, a company that archives 16mm educational films, as well as Kendra Madding-Lampron, a health teacher at Central Park School for Children in Durham. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You can find more about the show, our guests, and everything we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. While you're there, you can also find links to the rest of the Embodied series. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, and Katie Barron. Jenny Lawson is our technical director, and Josie Taurus is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.